think that we connect, that the chemistry is correct. Your words walk right through my ears, presuming I like what I hear. And I do when I turn on Columbia House Party. What's going on, man? How are you?
I'm good. I'm excited. Finally.
Finally, a ska album.
Finally.
And we have an audience.
Yeah,
and,
it's great.
This is going to be, this will be fun. This album is very good.
Oh boy. We'll get into it, but it's, I'm not going to say it's better than I remember it, but it's definitely better than I remember it.
It's just as good as I remember it. And sometimes you worry when you go back to things that, you know, oh yeah, I liked three songs on that album. And then you go back and it's like, oh yeah, that's only three songs. This album was the exact opposite, where it was like, oh, all the songs are really good and really different. And
I think like now as a quote unquote adult person, like obviously I love this as a ska record. And now it's like, oh no, all like the pop sensibilities on it that I didn't really appreciate when I was younger. Now I'm like, oh, everything about this album is incredible.
Yes. When before all you cared about was that it got Mighty Mighty Boss Stones and Real Big Fish more money from record labels.
Those horn players need to feed their families.
Yes. The same like eight horn players rotating through every California ska punk band for like a decade.
There's a link there from Superman by Goldfinger to this, which is fun.
Well, you can hit us with that,
buddy,
in the
if you think I'm not getting into a lot of ska today.
We're going to talk Goldfinger for sure.
Should have dug out my checkerboard wristband.
You definitely have one of those, don't you?
I was actually a few weeks ago. My parents are moving. So I was going through like old stuff to throw away. That was in my old bedroom. And found not one, but two separate checkerboard wristbands.
And those went in the keeper pile, right? Not the thrower pile?
Okay. What am I going to do? Throw away an old sweaty checkerboard wristband? Those are not dime a dozen. Can't get those just anywhere anymore.
Yeah.
Look, there's only so many hot topics I venture to now.
Yeah. I think you'd be fine. I think you could figure it out.
We'll see.
We are not talking about Goldfinger today. We are talking about pretty good ska punk album, though. I think ska punk's the right genre to call it.
Ska pop?
Sure.
I mean, ska pop might be like that. That was accidental.
This is going to be the first time we try something a little different. We have a guest on only for one segment, Cassie Lee Clancy of our sister podcast, Resting on Pretty. So we will get into a little fashion talk with her.
Which we are not qualified to do.
I'm certainly not qualified as someone who owns zero crop tops.
I am wearing a shirt that I bought because Cassie told me to dress better. So.
I was actually going to ask if you were doing something after this because you look really nice. And this is
but also like I was told to fix my clothing, basically.
I think this is the first episode we've recorded yet where you weren't in a band t-shirt.
Cassie has a photo of me holding a photo of myself from 2008. This one was taken in 2018, and I'm wearing the same Neutral Milk Hotel shirt in both the photo of me in 2018 and the photo of me in 2008.
Here's what you do now. You put that photo on a t-shirt, and you wear that.
Oh, that's good.
It's like, you won't get this reference, but it's like Orange Cassidy, who has, he's a wrestler, who his main main piece of merch is a photo of him wearing his own shirt. So the shirt has him wearing his own shirt. This is what you can do with the Neutral Milk Hotel.
Orange Cassidy sounds like it should be a dish somewhere. Like, I'm going to order the Orange Cassidy. No?
I don't think so.
All right. I thought it did.
In the 1995 movie Clueless, the opening couple minutes of that movie kind of bounces between a couple songs, they're very clearly trying to use music to set up not only where they live, but also what the main character share, like what her life is like, and kind of they're trying to set up her character, but also the world around her. And one of the ways they do that is with the song Just a Girl by No Doubt, which in that moment in the movie, you're seeing Cher drive this Jeep that her rich dad got her, and she's crashing into things, and she's, oh, I'm so helpless, I'm an airhead, which on its surface, Just a Girl kind of gives that vibe. It's this young, poppy person singing sarcastically over this ska beat. It very much fits, but underneath that, it also kind of sets up, because Just a Girl is a very sarcastic song about the way men underestimate women, in Gwen Stefani's case, her father underestimating her, but in general, just men underestimating women, especially young women, it does kind of set the tone really well for the movie, because as the movie progresses, you find out that Cher is this incredibly competent and, you know, a capable person. And not to go too deep on a mid-90s pop movie, but Clueless is really good.
Clueless is great.
And Just a Girl by No Doubt is a really good way to set it up. So for all those reasons, today we're talking about an immensely successful album from 1995 that stretched the definition of a genre, opened an adjacent genre up to a quick minute in the spotlight, and launched a massive pop career. It is one of the most single-heavy albums of the 90s, and a quirky tour de force of vocals, style, and messaging. Today, We're talking about No Doubt's Tragic Kingdom.
Take this pink ribbon off my eyes. I'm exposed and it's no big surprise. Don't you think I know exactly where I stand? This world is forcing me to hold your hand. Cause I'm just a girl living in captivity. Your rule of thumb makes me worry so. Oh, I'm just a girl. What's my destiny? What I'm supposed to do is making me numb. Oh, I'm just a girl. My apologies when I become so burdensome. Oh, I'm just a girl. Lucky me. Tweet all dumb. There's no comparison. Oh, love it all too. Oh, love it all too. Oh, love it all too.
That's just a girl. That's if you remember Clueless at all. I'm sure you can picture the scene in Clueless if you've ever seen Clueless and like that song. It's
a song that until I went back to this album in prep, in my brain, that's been track one on this album for for years.
It's always weird when when I'm picking what the first clip will be, you want it to do, you know, a couple different things. A lot of the time it ends up being the first song on the album because that's, you know, what most people... That's how you prime someone for the album.
To quote The Hotelier, it's an introduction to the album.
Yes, which is a great album opener.
It is.
It's perfect. Just a Girl is not the album opener.
No, it's just for some reason in my head, I feel like this album is, like, we talk a lot about your batting order theory, yeah, about how to structure an album. This album might be the most successful album we've discussed, and it completely goes away from the batting order theory, in my opinion.
I don't know about that.
I feel like it does.
Biggest single is number two.
No, biggest single is like number nine.
Oh, yeah, down the... So, sorry. It's probably its most resonant song today is number two.
Fair.
Just a Girl.
I guess so. Maybe I just have different opinions
also,
on this album.
Yeah, it also has a great opener.
It does. It's the most one of the most ska singles of all time.
On top of the reasons we outlined before, there are a couple other reasons that Tragic Kingdom fits the podcast, I think. We are called Columbia House Party, which is a riff on Columbia House, which is how a lot of people got their music in the mid to late 90s. This album, having come out in 1995, kind of fits right in that window. Had it not come out the same year as Hootie and the Blowfish's Cracked Rear View, it might... have, you know, it's hard to find accurate records of the highest selling Columbia House albums other than the top of each year. Hootie and the Blowfish is the top selling Columbia House record of all time, as far as I can find. I don't think those stats are official.
I'm actually surprised this isn't.
There is a wrinkle in that we're going to get to, where the success of Tragic Kingdom kind of spread out over 2 years. It's this weird thing where it wasn't initially all that successful. So I wonder if that played a part, and we'll get into that a lot when we talk about how this album was received initially and historically. Anyway, so around this time, Columbia House accounted for 15% of all CD sales. That's per Funding Universe retrospective. They didn't have the data sourced, so I'm putting some faith in them there, but that is what they said. It's kind of this cool snapshot of the mid to late 90s. Obviously, they were a big music video band. Their music videos helped propel their success. They followed a formula that would seem wild now, but worked at the time, in that they rolled out 7 singles over 2.5 years. It's weird. It's just
funny.
The,
like,
mid to late 90s are such an odd look back compared to now, and how music is released and how it gets to people. Like, there's almost no urgency other than, like, you want to have one single to drum up interest for the album, but then, like, everything was so, like, there was just no urgency to it. It's like, it yeah. wasn't like it is now, where every week you're going to be oversaturated with new music. They were just like, no, if you have a good album and you have a couple singles, the sales are rolling slowly. And
like, yeah, you see it from a lot of albums in this time, that idea of, like, oh, I know every song on this album.
Because there were 7 singles.
Yeah.
There's also, you know, there are some other ways it represents the mid to late 90s. Well, Gwen Stefani's kind of fashion forward look obviously had some, not some, it had a lot of influence, which is something we're going to talk about with Cassie later in the podcast. It being kind of a ska punk or ska pop album.
That super tight snare drum.
That it was semi responsible for the late 90s kind of boom that that genre had and then quickly went away.
Never went away. It's just got another wave.
There's also, like, I'm not qualified to speak to this thoroughly, but, like, there's some early wave pop feminism in here as well with some of Gwen Stefani's lyrical content and the, you know, we'll get into a little bit about how once this album was such a success, you know, she was like inundated with young girls telling her how much she meant to them and things like that. And then because the message was pretty like pro women, like I said, with Just a Girl, like, hey, and 16 is another song that gets into it too, is like, you know, we're capable, piss off.
We were kind of talking about this in prep for this. I think it's so interesting how this album is, despite its success, unquestionably a mid-90s ska punk pop record. But how well this one, like, I think you go back to a lot of ska punk music from 1995, and a lot of it's either...
And you do.
I do.
The rest of us don't.
Yeah. But it's either, like, a lot of the lyrics are either outright offensive or just... trite and like have an
trite's age a well. Good word for it. I thought about ripping it off when you texted me that. I was like, trite's a good word. I'm gonna use it before Jake can.
I win. But I think that because these songs are coming from the perspective of a woman and they are written in those ways, it's aged better, and it also seems way less like we're a bunch of frat idiots making frat idiot music, which I think a lot of, not all ska punk was like that, but a lot of it was.
In preparation for this episode, I had to watch some Sublime interviews.
Yeah, it's rough stuff.
Yeah, I will just say that this holds up better than anything to do with Sublime does here in 2020.
Sure does.
This album was also a Christmas gift Steve got me once and was like, you want to talk about ska all the time? Here.
He didn't give you a pop album to talk about
ska?
No,
he did not. He actually gave me this and was like, you stop talking about ska. Here's a ska album. We're going to talk about Tragic Kingdom in detail after this. So, in 1986, Gwen Stefani was 17. Her brother, Eric Stefani, and their friend John Spence decided to create a band. They were a two-tone three-piece with John as the lead and Gwen mostly doing harmonies. They were heavily influenced by bands like Madness, an English ska band that Gwen Stefani once told Spin was, quote, the only thing I was really into in high school.
I can't relate at all.
Growing up in Anaheim and only liking English ska is...
Whatever, man. Madness kick ass.
Cool. Cool. So, you know, they played some live shows and they got some good buzz for the energy and, as you'd expect, you know, kind of the stage presence or whatever. Then they added Tony Canal as a bassist, and then he quickly became the band's manager and also Gwen Stefani's boyfriend. So they were then a four-piece. In late 1987, a year and change after they had formed, John Spence tragically committed suicide. So that kind of put... Before the band had done anything, they were kind of in this weird spot. Alan Mead joined, and he was temporarily on vocals. He left the band to get married and start taking life a little more seriously at 17.
Oomst.
Yeah, yeah. That's half the age you're supposed to do that at, but he says at 33 and single. So because of those changes and that tragedy and Alan leaving, Gwen Stefani kind of ends up in the lead vocal role, which... as it turned out, was absolutely the right spot for her. Maybe not the most traditionally talented vocalist, but in terms of energy and presence and an ability to take a ska song and make it pop accessible, pretty good choice. Early on, there was a lot of turnover at the other spots as well. Eventually, they settled on Gwen Stefani on lead vocals, her brother Eric on guitar and keyboards and doing a lot of the writing, Tom Dumont on guitar, Adrian Young on drums, and then they had rotating trumpet, trombone, and sax players. And then also, like, everyone in the band is at times credited with keyboards. So I guess just whoever's instrument wasn't being used in that song, it was like, hey, you're on keyboards for this one.
That's funny. We've had a lot of bands on this show that, like, have the Spinal Tap drummer treatment. I think it's the first one to have the Spinal Tap keyboard treatment.
Yeah. So this was initially like a five-piece band plus the brass section that was rotating in and out. They eventually, after this album and kind of where No Doubt landed, once there was some stability, they landed as a six-piece with a full-time trumpet player and a full-time trombonist. Full-time, but not full-time, but they would tour and do sessions with them. So for all into, they're not listed as official band members. The band is officially four, but those two guys, Stephen Bradley and Gabriel McNair, have been with the band for their tours and their sessions for years and years.
Interesting.
It's like, you know how Wikipedia has those band members? Yeah, and then like
the touring session.
They've been there forever.
Huh.
They've been there forever. So, but at the time, they were a four-piece and then a five-piece with rotating brass, which, as you can imagine, was a little, you know, complicated to nail down a sound that was both something that they liked, that the entire band could agree upon, and that was had any chance commercially. So early on, they're getting some buzz for the live shows. Tony Ferguson brings Jimmy Iovine and a few others from Interscope to see them perform. Iovine says, quote, "That girl will be a star in 5 years." That's something that Gwen Stefani in 1996, after Tragic Kingdom blew up, said to Spin, and Spin asked Jimmy Iovine about it, and he was like, "I can't believe she remembers that. Like, I was just spitballing, basically. This was in 1991. I was just like, you know, here's a time frame. She's got star power." Well, it turned out to be super accurate because 5 years later, she was going to become a huge star. Before that, their 1992 debut album did not do much. That was at the time when kind of everything was the Pacific Northwest grunge scene, and a ska band from Anaheim was not the kind of thing with an upbeat sound too was the issue. It wasn't just ska versus grunge. It was also, you're not angsty, you're having fun. What is this?
Yeah, and they weren't swing, so I guess it didn't catch on.
It only sold 30,000 copies. Interscope refused to fund a single. There was some push on a second album, so they ended up producing it themselves. That was called the Beacon Street Collection. That came out in 1995.
It's a very ska album name, I think.
Because they recorded it at a homemade garage studio on Beacon Street.
That makes sense.
In Anaheim. And basically, what that album was all the songs they'd written already that they knew Interscope wouldn't like. So they were like, yeah, you know what? We're leaning in. We're going to produce this one ourselves. It was much more of a ska punk sound with vocals from Brad Knoll of Sublime on one track. Maybe no song sounds as 1995 as this, Total Hate 95, from early No Doubt featuring Sublime. Check it out.
As a ska person, I am not familiar with No Doubt's like early discography. I love that.
It's a lot, man.
I love that.
So at this point, it does a little better. It sells about 100,000 copies, which compared to their debut release is quite a lot. There's a weird thing going on, though, as No Doubt is figuring out whether they're going to be a successful band or not, in that Eric Stefani, Gwen's brother, and the guitarist who writes a lot of the songs, he wrote 6 of the Beacon Street songs to 5 for Gwen, and they only wrote 1 together. So it was a little bit of a trade-off of like, this is an Eric song, this is a Gwen song. And some of the other band members contributed to the writing too, but for the most part, that was kind of the dynamic, and Eric carried a little more of it. He was also starting an animation career, though. He was a writer on Tragic Kingdom and recorded some of them, but at some point during the Tragic Kingdom process, he left the band to take a job as an animator on The Simpsons.
Yes, that's right. They're in the background of the Homer Palooza episode, yeah.
And he drew them.
Oh.
So prior to him leaving, most of Tragic Kingdom was done, so songwriting presence is still felt. However, on Tragic Kingdom, Gwen Stefani either wrote or co-wrote all but one song, the title track Tragic Kingdom, which ends the album. So Eric Stefani's influence is still felt there, but this is much more a Gwen album. As Tom Dumont said to No Doubt Online in 1996, there's a reason the sound of our music has changed, and it's not because we've sold out, easy for me to say. Eric, our keyboard player, used to write most of our songs. He was the main creative force in the band for many years, and at a certain point after that first album came out, he had this personal thing. He didn't like touring. He didn't like all that stuff. He just liked to sit down and write songs. That's him. He's the artistic side, the total Mr. Creative. Things changed, and Tom Dumont continues, it's a really natural thing for our songwriting style to be different than Eric's. We're just different people. I mean, we've learned a lot from him, and he taught us a lot of things about songwriting, but we write simpler music. We have a simpler style. We're not quite genius like him, I think. This album was our first attempt. It was Gwen's first time really writing all the lyrics herself. So to me, it went the opposite from selling out. We've done something that's more personal, which, you know.
I buy that entirely, especially... Yeah. In like the sort of ska punk scene, that sort of tracks also the album's sort of separation from that. I don't remember them being considered like quote unquote sellouts, but.
No, and I think, I mean, you sold 100,000 records or 135,000 over your first two albums. I don't know if there was enough of an audience to call them yeah. sellouts. The sound gets a little more pop accessible. Gwen takes a much bigger presence, which obviously was integral to the success of the band. It also... The change in songwriting and the change to a simpler style got Interscope back on board. So they tagged in Paul Palmer, who had just mixed 16 Stone from Bush, which is also on the label, which you might know there's another Bush and No Doubt connection down the line between Gwen Stefani and Gavin Rosdell. So at that time, Paul Palmer had his imprint Trauma. They were partnered with Interscope. So he does a lot of the mixing on here with David Holman. As Paul Palmer told Spin, I thought they were fantastic the minute I heard the music. It was all there, even in the roughest stages. I had a feeling about the band that I couldn't let go of. They also had Matt Wilder producing, who would eventually go on to do Christina Aguilera, Kelly Clarkson, and Miley Cyrus. So another person in the booth with them who clearly has some pop sensibility.
There's definitely some songs on here, specifically one, which we'll get into, that like you can hear that early, mid-2000s pop production sound on so clearly.
And where Gwen would go really
totally, yeah.
on her own. And oddly enough, she didn't work with him as a solo artist, as far as I could tell.
Huh.
But it would fit that, you know, his influence in the booth and the success of Tragic Kingdom kind of continued to nudge Gwen Stefani that way. The other thing going on during the Tragic Kingdom process is Gwen Stefani and Tony Kanaal broke up. Even though they tried to, you know, or not even tried to, by their own admission, this is a little simpler of an album from a songwriting perspective. And they felt that they didn't want to be angsty just to be credible and popular. So they tried to keep some level of, you know, maybe not optimism, but they just didn't feel forced to fit the mood of the early mid-90s. Despite all of that, the breakup undercutting a lot of Gwen's songwriting means that this album still kind of runs the full gamut of pop album topics, like this song, Happy Now.
Might interrupt idealistic will so hard to please. Put your indecisive mind at ease. You're broke for sick now. There's only singles. There's no looking back. And this time I'm beating on
that fucking snare sound. I don't know what it is about every ska punk band in 1997 that someone's just like, just make sure the drum's really tight. Like, it's so tight that it doesn't sound like a drum. And like, you can hear it and you'd be like, I know when this album was produced.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's so silly.
You gotta have a... Every era has to have an imprint.
That's true.
So that song is about Gwen Stefani and Tony Kanal breaking up. You would think it might be a little awkward then for him to still be in the band and still touring with them and still performing this song. In his own words, quote, it's fucking surreal. So he's on stage playing these songs that are about him.
Don't just kill me.
To the credit of both of them, even as early as 1996, when they were doing a lot of the like cover story press, they both seem to have like almost immediately like a pretty good perspective on things. For Kanal, he said he basically just had to separate himself from the lyrics and like he was able to do that and compartmentalize. Gwen Stefani said she had a little more trouble with the actual breakup. And for a year, she basically acted like they were still together and tried to like force him to kiss her and stuff like that. And that was a lot of how it sounds by her description. The relationship started was she was just like, we're dating now.
Huh.
But she also has recognized in interviews that, yeah, it's probably unfair to him because she's the only one who gets to tell her side of the story. And she said things like, well, he didn't get to tell his side about how, you know, overbearing I was and things like that. So, you know, we don't need to get into the details of that other than to say that it made for good songwriting content and they both managed it pretty maturely and seemed to have a good perspective on it. So good for them.
I also assume that the legions of adoring fans and millions of dollars based on it probably
helped. The millions of dollars would probably
help. I feel like I could compartmentalize if it was like, you're going to make so much money.
Yeah. But you might not have known that at the time.
That's
right?
True.
Like, especially going through the recording process.
That's very true.
You'd sold 135,000 albums on the, over the last, or yeah, over the
so
last
like when you're albums, on stage so. Though, if you're like,
yes, eventually. Yeah.
It's like, this is fine.
Yeah. And then there ends up being like later on a weird thing where as they get popular, you know, Gwen is such a significant figure relative to the rest of the band.
Mm.
And that,
the out of focus guys,
that is its own thing, but that's not really related to, I mean, I'm sure that wouldn't help with the, the breakup side of things, but they seem to handle it fairly well, as millions of dollars might help you. We played Just a Girl off the top, which was in Clueless. It was the first single off of Tragic Kingdom. It hit number 23 on the Billboard 100 and number 10 on the Modern Rock chart. It also charted in the UK. That's a pretty good track about the stereotypes that people apply to women, especially young women, and how they're underestimated. It was probably the right lead single choice given what her eventual impact was and what the initial core of their fan base was. I know you had some thoughts on Just a Girl and 16 as kind of a duo. I know we talked about it a little bit earlier.
I think it was like, at this time, when this album was being recorded, they'd yet to sort of break into the, let's call it, pop side of things. They're still very much stuck in the like the LA or California ska punk groups. And you go back and you listen to a lot of, specifically think about like Goldfinger and Real Big Fish, which, especially Real Big Fish, who I believe Turn the Radio Off also came out in 1997, which is also a huge landmark ska punk album. Obviously not nearly as successful as this, but in the sort of ska scene, it's looked at as like one of the big ones. I would say like 75% of that album has aged really poorly, and it's mostly due to lyrical content. And none of this album has aged poorly, even though they sound very similar.
Huh.
Tragic Kingdom definitely has the pop sensibility, the pop side. Like, there's nothing on Turn the Radio Off that sounds anything like Don't Speak or even something like 16 or even something like Just a Girl, to be honest. But like Spiderwebs is just a ska tune. And
we'll talk Spiderwebs.
I know, but like, I just think it's interesting that the difference in lyrical content and coming from a female perspective, even though the sound is so similar, changes everything. And I know that sounds like an obvious statement because obviously perspective changes everything. But I think in this scene specifically that gets looked at and lumped in as this like sort of fratty boy joke genre, which I don't think is an unfair thing to say, how much just that little, or I guess major if you look at it in certain ways, change can make.
Yeah, and I think it's a part of why, no doubt, and this album in particular, have resonated for a long time. Gwen Stefani said, you know, in the aftermath of writing this, I really don't think guys understand what a burden it can be sometimes. The Observer in 2015, in a great piece from Alana Kaplan, called it quote, one of the most prominent feminist anthems of the 90s, that referring to Just a Girl, but also the album at large. Alana Kaplan wrote, for misunderstood teenage girls everywhere, Stefani stood out as a central voice for the misfits. She was never quite a Lannis or a Spice Girl. Stefani was a tomboy who wasn't afraid to speak up for anyone who was in between. She was the pretty, creative, artsy girl in high school that wasn't afraid to stick up for herself or you. She was a punk in plaid who served as just one of the guys. Stefani was one of the women that you looked up to for incredible vocals and I don't give a fuck sentiment. Which, you know, all of that stuff helps as you gain popularity. And
absolutely. When I was into ska when I was 13, I barely gave No Doubt the time of day because there was no, that feminist frame of reference didn't resonate with me because I was a 13-year-old boy. And so I think it's interesting.
See,
the
I
flip
like
side of it.
But
I like them so much more now because of it.
I was gonna say, see, and I liked them at the time, but was like wholly unaware of that going on the album, right?
Right. I didn't like not listen to them because they had a girl singing. It just
right.
didn't resonate the same way as like Aaron Barrett singing about beer in Real Big Fish did. Because I was like, I get that. I'm 13.
Yeah, I tended to like it because there were just kick-ass songs, yeah. Like Spiderwebs.
Going back to the album, I think I forgot how ska.
As the opener, too.
Yeah, like, I think Don't Speak, which we will talk about, was so big, it shifted sort of my perception of the album to it being a pop album. Then you're trying to, like, oh, right, this is a 1997 ska album.
Yeah, like, if you go back and listen to No Doubt's second album, and then you fired up this one right after, it's Spiderwebs is a pretty logical fall. It's totally. Like, oh, they got cleaner, they got tighter, but they're still the same band. And then the album, and even Just a Girl, like, kind of fits.
Yeah.
And then it goes from there. It's like, oh no, they, you know, they changed a little bit. And the simplicity is probably not the right word. It's the word they used a bunch of times. I don't know that it got simpler.
I think it just
pop
sensibility.
Yeah, and it got a little tighter. And, you know, ska could always, we've talked about before, albums and artists who need an editor. Ska needs an editor
totally.
At large. So,
no, absolutely.
Like, and having some pop producers and mixers in there.
There's just
or
some
a rock
smarter
ska,
songwriting. I almost said songwriting, which is kind of funny. But
it's not. Don't ever use it.
Sorry. There's smarter songwriting on this album, I think. Not to say there isn't very good pop songwriting on other ska punk records, because there is. But this took it, I think, just a little bit further.
And I think one thing that also, like, obviously that's an incredibly ska opening, but the course of Spiderwebs is pretty pop punky.
Mm-hmm.
So for that moment too, as you're getting into the late 90s and this is your second single, you know, that's something that helps you cut through as well in terms of getting radio play or, you know, Much Music play or
especially
MTV.
Especially in 1997.
Much Music. I gotta stop saying Much Music as my reference for where music videos are played, just because at some point we're gonna have American listeners and they're like, what the hell are you talking about?
I guess, but I mean, like, that is where we got it, though.
Yeah.
Like, that was where it was all played.
Also, they did a ton of promotion for this album through Much Music and HMVs.
Yeah. Oh,
that's how they did it. Anyway, Spiderwebs was the number two single. It hit 5 on the Billboard Modern Rock chart and 11 on the Mainstream 40, 16 in the UK. So we've covered 2 singles. There are 5 more. Excuse Me, Mister, also singled, as did Happy Now. Hey You was a single in limited release, only in some countries. But if you count Hey You, 5 of the first 6 songs on the album were singles, and they all have like a kind of different song. Like it goes from ska to pop punk to just like pop songs. It's like there was a little something to everyone to get a taste of No Doubt and find something they'd like within it.
I definitely had a period of my life where I conflated the fact that these were all on the same album. Like I was like, right, Don't Speak is definitely Tragic Kingdom. And Spiderwebs is definitely Tragic Kingdom. But like I remember being like, is Just a Girl on the follow-up? Like it's just because there's so many of them.
And because they rolled them out over 2.5 years.
Yeah.
So Different People is like, it's a little bit of a like a cheesier motivational song. It's cute. It's very ska.
Yep.
I do find that there's not a lull in the album because the album's really strong top to bottom. But after, you know, the top 4 kind of just kick your ass, there's like a little bit of a, okay, maybe I don't remember these songs or they don't stand out as much. And then you get toward the back part of the album and you get hit with Sunday Morning and Don't Speak back to back, which I know Sunday Morning was not the most successful single on the album.
It's the best.
But it's really, really good.
So good.
And then Don't Speak is just this massive song that had so much success and sounds like this.
You and me, we used to be together, every day together, always. I really feel that I'm losing my best friend. I can't believe this could be the end. It looks as though you're letting go, and if it's real, well, I don't want to know.
We run into this before about a song that's like the big hit that sounds like it was thrown in by the label. Don't Speak doesn't sound like anything on this record, and it was so massive.
There's some irony here too in that, again, Eric Stefani was leaving the group. This is the last song him and Gwen wrote together. It was also nominated for Song of the Year by Duo or Group at the 1998 Grammys, even though this album came out in 1996.
We'll never understand the Grammys, like year eligibility rules.
And for as much as Happy Now is pretty straightforward about what it's about, this one is really straightforward about what it's about. This is the Gwen Tony breakup song. It was huge. It hit number 1 on the Billboard Hot 100 Airplay and was there for 16 weeks. That was then a record, although it technically couldn't be on the Billboard Hot 100 proper because they didn't release it as a commercial single.
Really?
Yes. So it was only on the it was only number 1 on the Hot 100 Airplay. And it was there for 4 months, but it technically wasn't on the actual Billboard Hot 100.
Weird.
Yeah. Also, who decided not to release this as a commercial single?
Right. It was
like at that point, people were still buying singles. Maybe it was because it was released 6 months after the album came out. But to that point, the album actually hadn't been super successful. It had done well, but not crazy well. And it's when Don't Speak starts to have the success that it starts picking up a little bit. We're going to talk about that in a moment. The one other note I have from the album is that Tragic Kingdom, which is the final song and obviously the title track and the last Eric Stefani only song, basically sounds like if you dropped a ska song into the Nightmare Before Christmas. And I like it a lot for that reason.
Sounds like the Mad Caddies.
We're going to talk about the weird success path of Tragic Kingdom and its influence. And we're going to bring on a guest after this. All right, so I mentioned before that this album wasn't initially crazy successful. It wasn't unsuccessful, but it stayed in the 100 to 200 range on the Billboard 200 album charts until February of 1996. Then it jumped into the top 100. In December of 1996, it hit number one for the first time, more than a year after it was released. It then stayed there for 8 weeks. And then went back to number one after it had fallen out of number one. So a year after this album comes out, it hits number one and is just like the biggest album in the world, but it's been out for a really long time. I'm sure there are other examples of albums like this, but none come to mind.
Is that because of the success of Don't Speak?
And just all the singles in general. And they toured for 2.5 years off of this album. And I think it just slowly gained momentum in that way. But it's so wild. It is crazy that this came out in early October 95 and December 96, it hits number one for the first time and then is like the undeniable biggest album in the world for 2 months.
Maybe I'm incorrect in this assessment, but like Don't Speak was released non-commercially and later, but to me, at least even at the time, not even in retrospect, that is like, that's the first song I think of when I think about this album.
Now, yeah.
Now, or even then, like I remember when Don't Speak broke. And it was like, oh, this is everywhere.
Yeah. And the video.
And the video,
is,
yeah.
Like, I think everyone can kind of picture it. Initially, critics were mixed positive too. I think a part of that problem, going back and reading some of the reviews, was that male writers were just kind of being shitty about it, which, you know, there are some legitimate criticisms.
Doesn't sound like male music writers.
Look, there are some legitimate criticisms you can make about that album, but when you layer it with things like, I guess sex still sells, or half your album review is describing what Gwen Stefani looks like, I don't trust that your critique of the album is actually about the music.
That's such an odd, like, they never struck me as a band that, like, obviously they pushed Gwen forward as a personality, but I don't ever remember considering her as, like, them using sex to sell the band.
No, the whole point was that she was kind of a tomboy, right?
Right.
That was supposed to be part of the appeal that she was, like, I mean, I don't want to speak for everyone, and I was fucking 10 years old, so I wasn't old enough yet to realize she was gorgeous. Like,
totally, but like, never struck me as a like sex forward.
Yeah, I
band.
I was a little surprised at, and like maybe there's stuff in the videos that I'm just not remembering, but like none of the album art is like overtly sexy or anything. I don't know. I think it was just the
and
fact
like the
that
lyrical
it was,
content isn't either, which is
no, it's mostly a breakup album.
Yeah,
maybe it's just that it was a weird genre and like people didn't understand it. So, but there were a handful of those in the like medium to negative reviews that I read, and I'm sure that
sounds just like male music writers being like, a successful band with a lady.
Well, screw them, because this album has sold over 16 million copies. It went diamond in the US and Canada, Jesus. Platinum in the UK, triple platinum in Australia. Rolling Stone put it number 441 on its top 500 albums of all time. We talked about it had 7 singles. They got nominated for Best New Artist and Best Rock Album at the Grammys. They toured it for 2.5 years, got on Warped Tour, eventually had their first tour as a headliner. Gwen Stefani's stage energy was so high that at one point she broke her foot, and every concert date she had to like heavily tape her foot up so she could still run around and dance around and be a maniac on stage. Gwen Stefani in 2016 told Spin magazine, this was the cover story I mentioned where Gwen was on the cover and they had approached No Doubt about, we want Gwen on the cover and you guys can be in the story. And the band was like pretty conflicted on whether to do it. They ended up going through with it. Anyway, Gwen Stefani says, I can't believe this is my life. This is my loser band. I never thought me, this loser from Anaheim, could have any effect on anyone. You think maybe you bring a little happiness to these kids. They're going to remember that. Like I would talk about Madness. They're going to talk about No Doubt. How cool is that? So right away, it's like the young female fans, like clearly are what are driving Gwen Stefani, like pretty closely.
Love that she's still talking about Madness in interviews. Yeah, that makes me so happy.
And obviously she becomes like this breakout star from the band, which I think everyone knows within that. Yeah, the 1996 Spin cover story, by the way. It's a lot.
How so?
Like, smatterings of breathlessly excited, blonde-streaked, sparkle-lashed 14-year-olds litter the backstage area of San Francisco's fabled Fillmore, oblivious to the portraits of Janie's and Jimmy and the Jefferson Airplane scattered around the venue. These girls line up to press tokens of esteem on the recently adopted object of their devotion. No doubt's bare midriff, high-octane dreamboat frontwoman Gwen Stefani.
How dare those 12-year-old girls not get into Are You Experienced before they listen to No Doubt?
Unbelievable. From here, look, we need to talk about some other Tragic Kingdom stuff, some other Gwen Stefani stuff on the fashion side. So most people know what happened afterwards. No Doubt made a couple more albums in 2000 and 2001, but then Gwen Stefani went solo, became a pretty massive pop star with her first solo album in 2004. No Doubt never like officially broke up. The success of Tragic Kingdom is blamed or credited, depending on your perspective.
Credited.
For ska and ska punk having that late 90s moment that it did. Billboard in October 1997 had a piece set called Ska's Latest Revival Brings Music Stateside, which credited their success with more labels giving ska and ska punk a chance. So you're welcome or sorry from No Doubt, depending on who you are. Anyway, No Doubt releases two more albums. None get as big as Tragic Kingdom. Gwen is clearly leaning more and more toward pop. She goes that route. Then she releases four solo albums. And then 11 years after their last album in 2012, No Doubt releases Push and Shove, which it's really hard to tell if those songs are No Doubt songs or Gwen Stefani songs. Like this one, the title track featuring Busy Signal and Major Lazer. Give it to me straight when you smooth operate. Can you come out and play me for TikTok? Step up to the plate, no underestimate, no, never play it safe, no relax. So, you may have noticed a little accent on Gwen Stefani while singing that song, an accent that is not native to Anaheim, necessarily. This is where we get to something that mostly came post-Tragic Kingdom, so we don't need to go too deep on it, but I felt like it warranted mentioning, in that there has been some criticism of Stefani and her cultural appropriation in terms of musical style, vocals, and her look and her treatment of people of other cultures. In 2018, there was a Vice column from Juana Thompson that said Gwen Stefani has been problematic this whole time for a legacy of cultural appropriation. There was a 2014 Time column that said she owed everyone an apology before her comeback because of the Harajuku girl. Is that how you pronounce
Harajuku,
it?
Harajuku, I think.
Yeah, okay. Because of the nature of this conversation, I'm a little iffy about it. And even like in early, like Tragic Kingdom era, No Doubt She Wore a Bindi, the Looking Hot video got pulled because it was like people playing quote unquote cowboys and Indians, which I don't know how nobody thought, no one ever raised at any point that that was a bad idea. Anyway, there is too much there to unpack in total because this is a podcast about Tragic Kingdom, not about Gwen Stefani's solo career or the things that happened after. However, some of that criticism is also baked into another kind of pillar of Gwen Stefani's legacy in that she is something of a fashion icon as well. As her success with No Doubt and in the pop world grew, she pretty aggressively dug into fashion. Jake and I am wearing a Seattle Supersonics hoodie. Jake is wearing a collar shirt for the first time in the history of the podcast. We are clearly not qualified to talk about Gwen Stefani.
What do you mean?
From a fashion perspective. So we're tagging in my pal and your fiance, Cassie Lee Clancy. Cassie, what's going on? How are you?
Hi, how's it going?
It's I'm probably better for me than you, who have had to sit here and listen to us.
It's really interesting, actually, to see how it all gets made.
So we wanted to do something a little different here because I don't understand necessarily, or I can't communicate it, but I know that Gwen Stefani had a large influence beyond just ska and pop music and her influence on kind of a generation of young girls who were into her music. She became a mainstream celebrity with The Voice.
Yes, with The Voice.
The Voice and, you know, quite the fashion icon. Is that the...
Yeah.
Is that the name of the award officially?
Literally a fashion icon. Yeah.
There's an award called Fashion Icon?
Yep.
Hmm. The People's Choice Award.
Oh.
Which she received in 2019.
Yeah.
Look at that.
So, Cassie, fill us in on Gwen Stefani, fashion icon.
Absolutely. So to start out, Gwen, whenever people ask her about her inspiration and where she gets her fashion tastes, she always talks about how it always comes from thrift stores. When she was younger, that was the biggest thing. She never bought anything new. It was always old. She talks a lot about her mother, her grandmother, her great-grandmother, and how everybody was a seamstress. And so that is also what she does. So before Tragic Kingdom came out, she was more of a beach chic. And then when Tragic Kingdom was kind of just about ready, she did the platinum bob that we all know. She threw on the red lipstick and a lot of crop tops, bikinis with the baggy pants. So specifically in the music video for Just a Girl, that's pretty much her most iconic look. And she kind of uses that throughout the Tragic Kingdom career, which is just the white crop top, baggy blue pants. It's really simple, but it was something that I remember watching it, and obviously I saw it later because I'm not that old. But anyone from late 90s to early 2000s.
I was like 10 years old. It's not like I was 20 enjoying Tragic Kingdom.
But any girl who was of the age, she was such an inspiration because she did have this way of meshing femininity and kind of this badass punk rockabilly fashion sense that a lot of people weren't really doing in a big way like her. Another thing that she did include in this video, obviously, is the bindi, which is originally worn by South Asian women for religious and cultural practices, of which she is none of those. So that never really came up at the time, but as we know now, that's hugely problematic. But it did become part of her distinct look. So in 1998, she wore one of her most iconic looks on the red carpet, and this was for the MTV Video Music Awards. And so she deviated from her blonde hair briefly, and she did blue, and she did that to match her blue furry bikini top. Then she had a hovering black futuristic skirt over pants, which was an incredibly 90s look, and platinum sandals. So she also does her makeup in a classic way with her blue bindi and a couple more blue crystals along her eyebrows. And so this was a really, really huge look, and people started to really notice her as a fashion icon. Moving forward, in 1999, at a Christian Dior boutique opening, she did a pink look, which a lot of people thought was to draw attention away from her adult braces, which was another huge thing that she did because a lot of celebrities were not going out in public with adult braces, but she flaunted them proudly and with a big giant smile. And I like to think that was kind of the motivation behind Christian Dior customizing her wedding dress in 2002, where it was a white ombre to pink look, and this is where she started to become a lot more old Hollywood. So she was getting away from her ska punk rockabilly thing a little bit with the more fame she got. In 2004, she launched her solo career while not really letting go of No Doubt. So it was always just there in the background. But she did her first dive into designing with Lamb, which was also the name of her album, Love Angel Music Baby. Just some nonsense words thrown together.
Also the names she gave to the four individual Harajuku girls.
You're right. Yeah.
Oh, is, God.
Not cool.
Not great.
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
She was quoted as saying, "It's my passion and distraction from life. The music is so challenging, but the designing is so much fun. And while both are creative in their own ways, when I sit down to do Lamb, it's therapeutic." And she said that in 2004. Lamb showed her affinity and, as we know now, her cultural appropriation for international cultures with inspiration from Japan, India, Jamaica, and Guatemala. So New York Fashion Week debuted Lamb in 2005, and that's kind of when it hit huge around the world. Soon after that, she opened up her spinoff line, which was the most problematic, which was called...
More problematic.
More
right.
problematic.
It gets worse.
It was literally called Harajuku Lovers, and this was the introduction of her four Harajuku girls who basically just followed her around. She has gone on record defending the girls often. So what these girls would do, they were in her music videos, and they would actually go to award shows and red carpet events with her, and they basically just stood behind her and they would speak only Japanese. And it has been noted, but not proven, that these girls were actually American and could speak English, but were told to contractually only speak
totally
Japanese.
Totally normal thing to have happened 15 years ago.
It's funny.
Like it's not that long ago. And she was one of the biggest pop stars in the world.
Yeah. It's also funny, like going from like all the No Doubt history into this Gwen Stefani history, there is that moment in time, which I guess would have been around like 2003, 2004, where No Doubt stopped being No Doubt and became Gwen Stefani's
band. Yes. Yeah.
They were always kind of Gwen Stefani's band because she was obviously on the forefront, as you said, on the magazine covers and everything. But this is when it's like, oh, Gwen Stefani and also those guys she plays with sometimes.
Sometimes they were around and sometimes they weren't.
Her ex-boyfriend who has to watch all this and is a person of color.
And yeah. Literally watching it happen. Mm-hmm. Part of this Harajuku Lovers style was a lot of tartan prints with colorful tulle skirts and oversized floral accessories, which were huge for Harajuku fashion in Japan and not something that Gwen Stefani should have been appropriating. A lot of people were upset at the time about it, but she maintained that it was an appreciation and not an appropriation.
Well, she made an awful lot of money off that appreciation, I would imagine.
She made an insane amount of money. And following this, her style became more subdued, very much just regular Hollywood red carpet events, especially with the divorce from Gavin and her relationship with Blake Shelton.
Voice co-host and country music
star. The world's sexiest man. Look, if an average-looking dude named Blake can get named sexiest man in the world, let's go. This is...
Yeah, I forgot where I was sitting.
Yeah.
So in 2019, last year, she was named Fashion Icon at the People's Choice Awards and at the red carpet for this event. So she was given the award prior to the actual ceremony or the actual award show. But what she decided to wear to the red carpet was interesting because what she did was she wore a strapless white gown by Vera Wang, which was designed with black accents and the words Fashion Icon emblazed on the sides. So very, very tasteful, very beautiful, very red carpet. But what she did was pair it with knee-high black boots, black gloves to the elbows, and fishnets. So she's almost kind of calling back to her punk roots, which was kind of nice to see because it was a dress where you could kind of see what was going on her legs.
Which I like. I like the, like, especially because it's a Lifetime Achievement Award. Like, everything you do in every red carpet you do obviously doesn't have to call back to your roots. But when it's this sort of like, hey, the last 25 years of your life, you made this big impact. I like that. It's like a start to finish. Yeah.
And that's what's really nice to remind us of where she came from. Because for someone like me, I grew up in a very small town and I grew up with not a lot of alternative options when it came to clothing. So seeing someone like her at the front of a band wearing whatever the hell she wanted, it was really, really inspiring for me myself because I also love to do that. Now, I can't say that without recognizing her obliviousness to her appropriation throughout her lifetime of fashion. But at the same time, she was always one to be bold, to take risks, and to try a new aesthetic on top of her tomboy nature, which was really interesting and really helpful.
That was great. Thanks, Cassie.
Cool. No problem.
Now, Cassie, you also like Tragic Kingdom, right?
I do, yeah.
Okay, well, let's close it out. We got to pick a couple favorite songs, I guess. I mean, I feel like we're mostly going to agree. We don't need to go too deep on this because we have a sub question.
We do.
Jack Black voice.
Sub question.
I don't get it.
High Fidelity.
High Fidelity.
Mm. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
I know we disagree on our favorite songs from the album.
I think so, yes.
I love Spiderwebs, and I think it's...
I also love it. It's just not my favorite.
Yeah. Are you a Sunday... You're a Sunday
Morning guy? Yeah, okay. I love Sunday Morning.
I also really... Sunday Morning is one of my favorites on it as well. There are,
I mean, all of the... You could pick any of the singles and be fine.
Yeah, I think my hottest take on the songs is that Tragic Kingdom is really good.
I love that song.
Okay. No, I just thought it would be too weird. Like it's like Tim Burton ska. It's very...
Again, it reminds me of... As a ska... kid, it reminds me very much of bands like the Mad Caddies, who threw a lot of like almost klezmer sounding horns into them. Klezmer is an Israeli brand of music that is very horn heavy, and a lot of ska takes, not a lot of ska, some ska, Mad Caddies especially, take sounds from it, and Tragic Kingdom also does, and Mad Caddies rule, so it works out.
Eric Stefani, get it.
Yeah.
Cassie, what are your favorites on this album?
And it's tough because, like you guys mentioned, the most of them are singles, like most of them are so aggressively popular that picking any of those kind of seems like a cop out.
No, they were very popular singles
that's the thing. So I think that when I listen, and so I listened on my way here to kind of prep, and I think Just a Girl makes me feel the most and to remember what it was like to be younger and going to school, and I hung out with only guys, and it was just such a huge thing, and I get all those feels still when I listen to it.
It's a great song.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
It's really good. All right, sub question, Jake.
All right.
Favorite ska punk records of the 90s, not including No Doubt.
Okay, so can I cheat a little bit? Because
in what way?
Most of my favorite ska records came out in 2000 or 2001.
Sure.
Okay.
I don't care.
So my... well, you asked me the question.
Well, I mean... Yeah,
I'm just saying.
We get sure, late 90s, early 2000s.
There we go.
Whatever era of ska punk you want to talk about.
It's all the same era.
This is in this episode's run sheet just for you.
Fourth wave just started.
Just for you.
I didn't get it.
Yeah, Morbid Stuff was... It's
Morbid
up
Stuff's
Juno.
A great ska record.
Fourth wave ska. It doesn't even have its own category. It's got to be in there with Mac DeMarco and Orville Peck.
Well, yeah, because they're not making ska records.
No. Orville Peck could do ska.
He could do ska. It'd be great. Yeah, so my favorite ska record is from 2000. Which is Pay Attention by the Mighty Mighty Boss-Stones. It is actually one of their least ska albums in a lot of ways, which is funny, but it's very, very good.
That's probably why it's good.
Incorrect.
Sorry.
Incorrect take.
Jake,
incorrect.
I feel like the Skip Bayless, Stephen A. Smith meme right now. Now, Jake, you know I have an appreciation for ska. But.
I'm not saying ska is terrible. Anyway, also from 2001, Progress by RX Bandits is one of my favorites because RX Bandits would become so far away from ska. Later in their career, they morphed from a typical ska band into more of a prog rock band almost, but they were amazing all through. Progress is sort of the first hint of what was to come. It was kind of a blend of sort of more advanced, rockier music with ska. And as a 13-year-old, it was very political, which I enjoyed. I also really like, again, I'm cheating a little bit on the years. I brought them up earlier. Just One More by Mad Caddies is a great ska record. One of my first, like, oh, this band is like their live album was recorded in Toronto. I mean, I could go on about favorite ska records.
Sure. I have a much more mainstream list. Goldfinger's self-titled is like
your self-titled over Hangups?
Yeah.
Interesting.
I love that album. I feel bad that it's on the list, but if I'm being honest about the ones that I liked at the time and listened to the most, 40 Ounce to Freedom. The fact that Date Rape was a fucking single is
wild. Wild.
The entire existence of Sublime is so bizarre in retrospect. Yes. And like I said earlier, I had to watch some Sublime interviews in prepping for this, and oh boy.
No fun.
And then, does Rancid count?
I think so.
Yeah, because Out Come the Wolves is awesome.
I know, I was never a Rancid guy, which is weird, considering every
other
band.
Well, I know how fond you
to.
Are of Transplants. So. And then, I don't know that I ever like sat down and listened to a whole album of them, but I know I played a lot of like Kamuri songs.
Mm.
Yeah. positive mental attitude. Let's go.
I'm going to give a special shout out to an album from 2006, which is Catch 22's Permanent Revolution, which is a ska punk concept album about Vladimir Lenin and Leon Trotsky, and it kicks ass. Sure. It's about the life of Trotsky. It rules. Sure. It's so good.
Cassie, your favorite ska punk album?
Like, why are you even asking me? I don't know.
I thought you were going to get jokes in on Jake. All right, guys.
When Poppy releases a ska album, you guys will come around.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. If Poppy does that, I will 1,000% love ska.
Bubblegum pop metal is the best description I could come up with for her.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Anyway. We
got
to pick a song off Tragic Kingdom for the mixtape. What are we thinking, guys? I mean,
it's hard.
It is hard. I do think Cassie's point about the even now resonance of Just a Girl and how much that meant to Gwen Stefani's like kind of breakout as a singular figure with this huge fan base. I think it's probably the most important song, even though Don't Speak was this enormous single that drove them to popularity. I think Just a Girl is like the best representation.
I think Don't Speak is the most defining song of the album, but Just a Girl is the most quote unquote like important
it was so important.
Yeah. Okay. We're going with Just a Girl then. Cassie, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me.
You guys, thanks for listening to Columbia House Party. Jake, thanks for jaking.
Look, I got some ska out of me. It'll satiate me for a few episodes at least until I make us talk about something else that's ska.